The reading is Job chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Job 1, 1 through 5. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly.
We're going to begin this evening to study somewhat from the book of Job, a book that I've kind of become intrigued with. I was talking with Chris Simmons this past week, and I said that I'd been doing some studying from the book of Job, and it kind of just sucks you into it. There's not a place to put it down and study something else. But the book of Job is fascinating for many reasons. We'll get to some of that as our study progresses. But I want to begin with this question. Why do bad things happen to good people? Sometimes we look at our life and we say, well, I know that things are not like I would like for them to be. And it's very disquieting to me. And it's very difficult to get up in the morning and face the day because things are not as well as I would like for them to be. And we begin to look for some answers to why is that so? Why are things as bad perhaps as we perceive them to be? And whether the suffering be physical or whether it be mental or what it may be the result of are all things that sometimes trouble our minds. Whether it be from without in terms of things that happen in nature, earthquakes, floods, mudslides, fires, all kinds of horrible things can happen from that perspective and create great anxiety in our minds and concerns about why that's happening to me. And there is no question that whether it be that source or whether it be friends or relatives that seem to be our enemies in a relationship that ought to be a good relationship, we're disappointed and we're hurting and we raise the question, well, why? Why is it the way that it is? Now, sometimes the things that we suffer may be the result of our own poor choices, so we might refer to those things as self-inflicted. Sometimes those things are done with our full knowledge, willfully, and sometimes we do things that result in harm to ourselves in ignorance. And nonetheless, suffering seems to be the lot of all of us, doesn't it, from time to time? There are just problems along life's way, and we raise the question, not necessarily then what causes it, but what do I do with it when it happens? And I'm persuaded that that's a very legitimate concern. I have on the board the passage from Psalms chapter 73, and I want to read that with you, the portion of it, simply to note that this is not a new thing. When we call into question, why do bad things happen to good people? This is an old problem, an old concern. And as you read in chapter 73, it's referred to as the Psalm of Asaph. Surely God is good to Israel, even to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet were almost gone. My steps had well nigh slipped. For I was envious at the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pangs in their death, and their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride is as a chain about their neck, violence covereth them as a garment. Their eyes stand out with fatness, they have more than heart could wish. They scoff and in wickedness utter oppression. They speak loftily. They have set their mouth in the heavens, and their tongue walketh through the earth. Therefore his people return hither, and waters of a cup, a full cup, are drained by them. And they say, how doth God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked. And being always at ease, they increase in riches. Surely, in vain I have cleansed my heart and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I had dealt treacherously with the generation of thy children. When I thought how I might know this, it was too painful for me. Now hold your finger there. Do you see the dilemma that the psalmist is writing about? When I look at people that I know are wicked people, he said, they seem to prosper. And then I look at my life and I see that I'm trying to do what's right, and for some reason it seems that I have been plagued all the day long. I don't understand it. And so he begins with a false philosophy. You know, brethren and friends, sometimes our thinking is our biggest problem. When we begin with the wrong premise, we struggle with the affairs of life, and we struggle even with things that we know to be true, but our application is wrong because we've started at the wrong place. We've started with the wrong premise. It's really hard to start wrong and wind up right, isn't it? We're going to look at the reasoning of Job in our study tonight as we introduce some of these thoughts. And we're going to see that Job, though he suffered immensely, he began with the wrong premise. His thinking was, much like his friends who came to him to comfort him, Job, you've done something wrong. And bad things happen to bad people, so if I can figure out what it is that I've done that's bad, then I can fix that and I can end all of this suffering. But you see, Asaph, he had that messed up too. He looked at the wicked folks and he thought what they ought to be receiving was wicked things, evil things. And here he is, he's a good fella, and he thought good things ought to happen to him, but they're not happening. He looks at the bad folks and good things seem to be happening to them. And I want us to note that good things and bad things sometimes happen indiscriminately. It's not always punishment that comes upon me that makes me suffer bad things. So as we look at this question, we want that fixed in our mind. Why do bad things happen to good people? When we look at the greatness and the goodness of God, and we see this element of evil that exists in this world, it's going to do something to us based on our thinking. Now, what will it do? How do we resolve the existence of a loving God with evil things that seem to abound? Now, let me ask you, brethren, that becomes the atheist sugar stick, doesn't it? They look at God and say, well, he's all-knowing, all-good, and all that. And yet we see this element of evil, and a loving God just can't let these bad things happen. Have you ever had somebody tell you that? Loving God, as you read about in the Bible, he can't let these bad things happen. But yet these bad things happen. Now, what does it do? Why do those who are righteous suffer? Can God trust man to serve him even when bad things happen? Or does God have to reward us each time we do a good thing to bait us to keep us serving him? And then that prompts this third question. Can man trust God when his suffering seems to be so intense? Can he trust God when he can't understand the reason why bad things are happening to him? Now, some have taken that thought and run with it. One fellow said concerning God, is he willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent. That is, he just don't have any power. Is he able but not willing? Well, then that makes him a criminal, you see. Is he both able and willing? And if that be true, then why does evil exist? Now, those are, I think, legitimate questions. How do we reconcile all of this in our thinking? Now, you may remember, those of you who are somewhat history buffs, the early colonists that came to what we now refer to as the New England states, the majority of whom were devout Calvinists. Now, most of you know what that means. They believe that man inherits a sinful nature all the way back to Adam. And if there's anybody that's going to be saved, it's because God has handpicked them. Well, these early colonists thought that they were among the elect. And then they began to realize that bad things were happening to them. Now, what do you do with that? You see, some of them came to the conclusion that they just didn't have any more faith in God. They didn't know how to reconcile that bad things were happening to them, and they considered themselves among the elect. How do we explain that? So they abandoned their faith. Many of them becoming, at the very least, antagonist or agnostic, I mean to say, if not atheist. And so as we look at what your thinking does, it messes with your mind sometimes, doesn't it? And this was where the psalmist was until, turn back if you will to Psalms chapter 73 and notice verse 17. He said, until I went into the sanctuary of God and considered their latter end. Now I want you to think about that for just a moment. Because it was when he went into the sanctuary of God and considered the latter end of practicing evil things that he saw there are eternal consequences to doing bad things. And that doing bad things doesn't just warrant bad things happening to you in this life. No, not necessarily. And doing good things does not warrant that everything in your life is going to be cherry. It just doesn't follow that way. He saw the value of serving God and being faithful to God when he went into the sanctuary of God and he saw the latter end of those who were disobedient. And my friend, we want to take that home with us tonight. When we begin to think about the source of evil, let's turn back to the beginning. In Genesis chapter 3, in verse 1, the text says, now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Jehovah God had made. And he said unto the woman, yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of the tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, of the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. Now here we see that the very source of temptation is not God. The source of temptation was the devil from the beginning. And so when we're thinking about bad things, let's not attribute bad things always to a righteous God. Let's see where that started. That started with the devil. And when you begin to think about temptation, you understand the words of James as he writes in James 1, verse 12, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he hath been approved, he shall receive the crown of life which the Lord promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempteth no man. But each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. Then the lust, when it hath conceived, beareth sin, and the sin, when it is full grown, bringeth forth death. Now, where does temptation come from? Well, the devil does that, you see. Satan is described by Jesus in John chapter 8, beginning about verse 32, when Jesus said, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And those Jews that believed, underscore that in your mind. They said, we are Abraham's seed and have never been in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, ye shall be made free? And Jesus accused those very folks of being of their father, the devil. And then he identified who that is. He is a murderer. He is a liar. John tells us in 1 John chapter 3 that he sins from the beginning. Now when we begin to look at bad things happening to good people, Let's look at an illustration here in Luke chapter 13 where Jesus heals a woman who has been infirm for quite a long time. And I want to call your attention to a particular expression that's found here in Luke chapter 13 beginning in verse 10. Luke chapter 13 in verse 10. It says, "And he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath day, and behold, a woman that hath a spirit of infirmity 18 years, and she was bowed or bowed together and could in no wise lift herself up. And when Jesus saw her, he called her and said unto her, Woman, thou art loosed from thine infirmity. And he laid his hands upon her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. And the ruler of the synagogue, being moved with indignation, because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, answered and said to the multitude, There are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them therefore come and be healed, and not on the day of the Sabbath. But the Lord answered him and said, Ye hypocrites, doth not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and lead him away to watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan had bound, lo, these 18 years, to have been loosed from this bond on the day of the Sabbath?" Now, there's much to be said about this context, but I simply want to make the observation that Jesus attributed this woman's problem to Satan. Satan had bound her. The illness that she experienced was not something that was dependent upon her being a good person or a wicked person. Satan was the source of this. This is what happened. Satan hath bound her. Jesus released her from that in healing her. Now, let's go back and talk just a little bit about Job. In the passage that Joey read for us a few moments ago, let's ask the question, just exactly who is Job? Now, in our introductory material, likely next Sunday evening, I hope to have that ready to go. And we'll talk about some introductory material to the book of Job. But just for now, let's ask the question, who was Job? And notice in Job 1, verse 1, he's described as a perfect and upright man, one that feared God and turned away from evil. Would you describe Job as a good person or a wicked man? Well, he's a good person. But yes, some really bad things happened. Now, let's notice further about Job. In Job chapter 1 in verse 5, it says, "It was so when the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, It may be that my sons have sinned and renounced God in their heart. Thus did Job continually." There are many things that are revealed in that simple statement about Job offering sacrifices. But I want to call your attention that he's offering sacrifices and he does this on a regular basis. Do you see that? That's something a good man does. So on the beginning of just casually reading from this first chapter of the book of Job, we're reading about a good man. Now, Satan approached God and said that the problem with Job is you're rewarding him with all these good things, and that's why he's faithful to you. God said, "I want you to consider my servant, Job. You could take away everything he's got, but Job will be faithful." And in the first chapter, we won't elaborate on it in this study, but I simply want to note that in this first chapter, Satan smites Job in the sense that everything he owns is taken from him. All his sheep, all his cattle that you read about there beginning in verse 3, everything that he had was taken from him. And you'll notice that in that context of verse 18, that one came and reported, "Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee." Now, that expression, while he was yet speaking, that occurred over and over and over and over. Now, when you begin to look back and see all that Job had, and these reporters come in to tell him that everything you've got is gone. Everything. Your sheep, your camel, your asses, everything is gone. All of your possessions, it's all gone. And now here comes one in and says, "Your family too, they're all gone." Now when we look at that, we want to note some things. Number one, we want to note that Satan had at his disposal the instrumentality of men He used men to do these evil things to Job. You see that in verse 15. The Sabaeans fell upon them and took them all away. They slain the servants with the edge of the sword. Well, what else did Satan have the privilege of using? The text tells us in verse 16 that the fire of God has fallen from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone am escaped to tell thee. Here he has at his disposal the forces of nature. And as you read down concerning the sons and daughters, a great wind came about. A tornado or cyclone or something. Tore their house up and killed all of Job's family, all of his children. All gone. Now who did that? Satan did. He took it all away. And then we find that Satan approaches God a second time and said, well, he's still faithful to you because you blessed him. Let me add him. And God said, all right, you can smite his body, but you can't take his life. And we notice in the second chapter that he's described once again in verse 3 as a faithful servant, none like him in the earth, perfect and upright, one that fears God and turned away from evil. He holds fast his integrity. All right, you can smite his body. And the text tells us that he was smitten with boils from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. There are some who believe that that was a disease that is known, at least in modern medicine, as the Black Plague. I don't know what it was. It just tells us that he was had sores from the top of his head to the sole of his foot. The Bible goes on to tell us that he was sitting in the city ash heap. Now, that brings to mind a picture, does it not? Here's a man that is so smitten with boils, he's sitting over here in a pile of ashes to dry up the sores. And he's scraping out the infection with a piece of broken pottery. Now, what a pitiful state to be in. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot. And in verse 12, we'll note this in here, but we'll pick it up again in a moment. In verse 12, Job's friends, when they came to comfort him, it tells us that they knew him not. And here is a man that is so smitten that he's unrecognizable. His own friends don't even know who he is. I mean, they don't recognize him. They know who he is. They've heard of his plight and come to him. But they don't recognize him. Now, in verse 9, of chapter 2. It said, then said his wife unto him, dost thou still hold fast thine integrity? Renounce God and die. Now what we see is Job's own wife has said, go ahead and curse God. Now, it's not our purpose in this study to examine Job's wife in great detail, Linda, but I want to make this comment. We don't want to villainize Job's wife, but one thing that we do see is that Job's wife is not faithful to God. Do you see that? She does not maintain the integrity that Job has maintained. But one thing that we do want to see in Job's wife, to be charitable to her, we want to note that it would be difficult to see your companion that you love in this circumstance. Perhaps you would see death as a more viable choice than to see them suffering all of these afflictions. But we also want to note that Job's wife, she's lost everything too. These children were her children. 10 children, they're all gone. She can't run down to Walmart with a big bank either because all her source of income is gone too, you see. She suffers too because of these things that have happened to Job, but she did not maintain her integrity like Job did. The text tells us that Job referred to her as one of the foolish women. He said, shall we receive good at the hand of the Lord, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now, Job's dilemma was, I don't know why all this has happened to me. Now, as we begin our study of the book of Job, what we want to observe is that Job does not know of this conversation, if I may call it that God has had with Satan. He doesn't know. He doesn't know that Satan has had the privilege granted to him to take everything from Job. And he doesn't know that the suffering of Boaz from the top of his head to the sole of his foot is a part of this permission that God has granted to Satan. He doesn't know that. And he doesn't know, as you do when you read chapter 42, that he's going to be blessed multiple times over what he ever had to start with. He doesn't know that. All he knows is, presently, it hurts. It's awful. That's what he knows. And he don't know why. And perhaps not knowing why is one of the most difficult factors in the equation. He doesn't know why all this has befallen him. And here comes his friends. And his friends, as we say, if we've got friends like that, then who needs enemies? I want to notice just in brief some of the things that his friends said to him by way of trying to comfort him. His friends begin by explaining, and the first one is the speech that's made by Eliphaz. Now I want you to look at that. Eliphaz. And I'll get to that point in my notes. Right there it is. In chapter 4. Now before we look at chapter 4, I want to just make a brief observation in chapter 3. You read chapter 3. Job despairs even life. You ever been down? That down? Job says, if you will read in verse 1, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day. And Job answered and said, let the day perish wherein I was born. And the night which said, there is a man-child conceived, let that day be darkness. Let not God from above seek for it, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death claim it for their own. Let the cloud dwell upon it. Let all that maketh black the day terrify it. Now what's Job saying? Saying, I wish I had never been born. You see that? That whole chapter is just repeating statements of I wish I had never been born. Now it's not just this chapter. If you look just a little bit further in the book to the 7th chapter and read with me at verse 16, chapter 7, verse 16. Chapter 7, verse 16. Job says, I loathe my life. I would not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. You see somewhat in that a death wish? I wish I had never been born. I hate my life. It's awful. The agony is just terrible. And if you'll turn to the 10th chapter of the book of Job, he said, my soul is weary of my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. Job is in agony. Do you see that? And one of the things that I do want you to note just here is in spite of all of his wishing he had never been born, there's not a single bit of evidence that Job is contemplating taking his life. No, sir. Job maintains his integrity. He's going to serve God. Come what may, he's going to be faithful unto the Lord. In fact, if you'll note in the 13th chapter, in a part of his response to some of these speeches that are made, in verse 13, he said, hold your peace, let me alone that I may speak, and let come on me what will. Therefore should I take my flesh in my teeth. Now I'm reading from the American Standard Translation, just to note that. He said, and put my life in my hand. Behold, he will slay me. I have no hope. Now other translations, an alternate reading is, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Now that's where Job is in this. Come what may, the suffering, the agony, I don't like it. But come what may, I'm going to be faithful to God. Now Job's friends, I don't want to forget that. Job's friends They speak multiple times throughout the book of Job. But I want you to look at the message that they have for Job. Their message is not unlike Job's thinking. Their speeches all contain the element of, you must have done something wrong for all of these horrible things to happen to you. Now, before they began to speak to Job, notice, if you will, they came in chapter 2, verse 11, to bemoan and to comfort him. And when they saw him afar off, they did not know him. And they sat and looked at him for 7 days and didn't say a word. Now, that's a lot of help, isn't it? But when they began to speak, they began with the same premise that Job had, and that is, I've done something wrong. Only they're insistent. Job, you've done some awful things. And Zophar, I'm sorry, as Zelophehad, he begins in chapter 4. And look at what he says. If one essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was fallen, and thou hast made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Is not thy fear of God thy confidence, and the integrity of thy ways thy hope? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent. Or where were the upright cut off? Now let's hold your finger there. Do you see what Eliphaz is saying to him? He's saying very simply to him, Job, you've been a real good counselor to others. You can dish it out. You just can't take it. Now the chickens have come home to roost and you can't handle it. Now it's happened to you. And you're saying, woe is me. What you need to do is to remember that we've never seen the innocent perish. Bad things happen to bad people. Job, what have you done? Why don't you just acknowledge your sin? Now that's what he's telling. In verse 8, Eliphaz continues. He says, according as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Now what's the source of Eliphaz's authority? He appeals to what he's seen. Now let me ask you, beloved, do you think Eliphaz has seen everything? Sometimes our experiences are somewhat limited and we reach conclusions based upon our experiences that aren't correct. And so it was with Eliphaz because he began with the wrong premise. His experiences had simply confirmed his wrong premise. But his experiences were not extensive, nor were they exhaustive. You read further in the text, in verse 12. He said, now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a whisper thereof in thoughts from the visions of the night. All right, Eliphaz, you've got some information that's going to help me understand why I'm suffering all these horrible things. Yes, sir, I had a dream. And my dream told me this. You ever have a dream? Did it always represent the truth? Well, not necessarily. David, we might call that a nightmare, you see. Wouldn't be so. Now that's the authority to which Eliphaz is speaking in his first speech. But look at his second speech. Turn over to Job chapter 15. He doesn't lighten the load at all. In chapter 15, he just gets worse. It says, then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, should a wise man make answer with vain knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he could do no good? Yea, thou doest away with fear and hinderest devotion before God. For thine iniquity teacheth thy mouth, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. Now, Job, you think you're the first fellow that's ever had troubles? You see that in verse 7. And in verse 10, he said, with us are both the gray-headed and the very aged men much elder than thy father. Are the consolations of God too small for thee, even the word that is gentle toward thee? Now look at what's he appealing to. Why, the old man, the traditions of the old men, the things that we've always done, the things that we've always thought, they condemn you, Job. You've sinned. Evil people suffer. That's why you're in such agony. You just need to confess what you've done. Now in verse 17, Eliphaz, he says, I will show thee, hear thou me, and that which I have seen will I declare, which wise men have told from their fathers and have not hid. You see, wise men, they believe this too, so it has to be so. Now, friend, that's the reasoning of Eliphaz. Now, wouldn't that just make you feel real good to know that you had a friend like that? But look at his third speech in Job chapter 22. In Job chapter 22, Eliphaz said in verse 4, is it for thy fear of him that he reproveth thee, that he entereth with thee into judgment? Is not thy wickedness great? Neither is there any end to thine iniquities, for thou hast taken pledges of thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing, and hast not given water to the weary to drink, and hast withholden bread from the hungry. But as for the mighty man, he hath the earth, and the honorable man, he dwelt in it. Thou hast sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless have been broken. Therefore snares are round about thee, and sudden fear troubleth thee. Job, you want to know what's wrong? Here's what's wrong. Widows over here have been in need and you didn't help them. Here's folks over here that were hungry and you didn't feed them. Job, here's folks over here that were thirsty and you didn't give them anything to drink. Why, you even stripped the clothes off the naked. That's what you did, Job. All right, Mr. Eliphaz. Cite a for instance when I did any of those things. Well, he couldn't. And you see, if you're going to charge Job with practicing some evil, you need to provide some evidence of what he's done. Eliphaz doesn't provide any evidence. He just charges headlong and makes accusations. Now that's Eliphaz. Now look, if you will, for just a moment at Bildad. Bildad assumes the same position that Eliphaz did. Turn back, if you will, chapter 2. Go back to chapter 8, Job chapter 8. And here's Bildad, the Shuhite. In verse 2, he says, how long wilt thou speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like the mighty wind? Doth God pervert justice, or doth the Almighty pervert righteousness? Now, what's his reasoning? Bad things happen to bad people. God is righteous, and the conclusion is you're suffering bad things, therefore you're not righteous, Job. Now that's not a lot of comfort, but read on. In verse 4, he said, if thy children have sinned against him, and he hath delivered them into the hand of their transgressions, if thou wouldest seek diligently unto God and make thy supplication to the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. And you see his reasoning? Why, what's happened to your children? It's because they're evil too. Well, that makes you feel good, doesn't it? Your children are dead because they're just evil men. They got what's coming. Righteous God just killed them because they were doing bad things. And what you need to do is you need to seek diligently God. And if you'll seek diligently God, He'll relieve all of this on you. Now that's a real friend. Look at verse 8. He said, for inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and apply thyself to that which thy fathers have searched out. For we are but as of yesterday and know nothing, because our days upon the earth are our shadow. Shall not they teach and tell thee and utter words out of their heart? You see, this man, Bildad, he's offering the same opinion that Eliphaz had. Look back at the traditions of our fathers. Don't you know, Job, that folks have always believed that bad things happen to bad people? And bad things are happening to you, and therefore you're a bad person. You need to repent and seek God. Now, Zophar has to be my favorite out of these. Look at what he has to say in chapter 11. Zophar. Zophar said in verse 2, "Should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be justified? Should thy boastings make men hold their peace? And when thou mockest, shall no man make thee ashamed? For thou sayest, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in thine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against thee, and he would show thee the secrets of wisdom, for he is manifold in understanding. Know therefore that God exacteth of thee less than thine iniquity deserves." Boy, how'd you like a friend like that? Why, I've lost everything I've ever owned. All I've worked for all my life, all my herds and flocks and cattle, everything in my house, everything gone. All my 10 children are dead. And now mine own wife, she has instructed me to curse God and die. And here's one of your best friends, and he comes to you and he says to you, "You know, what you've experienced is nowhere close to what you deserve." And you talk about feeling kind of low on the totem pole, how you think Job feels? These men have come to comfort him. And that's the substance of what they have to say. I tell you, folks, that wouldn't be much comfort. I want to suggest to you that the real problem in all of this, and I know I've had this trouble with my outline. I can't stay with it on this. But what I want to note with you at this particular point is that all of these men, the friends of Job, even Job himself, has not correctly answered this question. Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, when we look at that question, I'm going to pass through some of these. Sometimes we assume to know all the answers to, like these friends of Job, why bad things happen. And I want to suggest to you that sometimes we're very rash in our response, like these men. And our response sometimes is not accurate. The Scriptures teach that there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. You may not have it all figured out just exactly right. But when we begin to answer this question, why do men suffer? We don't have all the answers. And that was what was so perplexing to Job. He didn't understand that. But he began with the wrong philosophy. And his friends, and yes, even his wife, they concurred with the wrong philosophy about suffering. Now, the Scriptures do answer that question somewhat. Very quickly, sometimes we suffer as a direct consequence of sin. Sometimes that's true. The Scriptures teach that you reap what you sow. And we understand that to be in a spiritual context. But if you smoke all your life and you wind up with lung cancer, then maybe the reason you've got lung cancer is you should not have smoked all your life. Now, I know sometimes folks have lung cancer and it's not because they were smokers. I understand that. But sometimes it is. Sometimes we reap what we sow. We do bad things, and because we do bad things, we reap the consequences of our own poor judgment. That's true. But that's not always the case. Some suffer because of the sins of others. When you look at John the Baptist, old Herod cut his head off. John was put in prison and he died because he preached that Herod was not to have his brother Philip's wife. Well, had John done something wrong? No. He did what was right. He was a preacher of truth and righteousness, but he suffered at the hand of others who committed sin. When you look at Stephen in chapter 7 and chapter 8, we know that Stephen was stoned to death. Well, was it because Stephen did something wrong? No. He suffered at the hands of others who were doing wrong things. Now, sometimes that's the answer to our question. Sometimes we suffer because other folks have the right to make choices. You remember when Joshua said, "Choose you this day whom ye will serve." We preach all kinds of lessons from that. And that's good. But what that passage indicates is that we have the ability to make choices. All of us do. And you know what? You may suffer because of choices, free moral choices that somebody else made.
you see.
In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, now I'm preaching to an audience that's familiar with these passages, so we'll not look at all of them. But you know in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul gives a laundry list of things that he suffered because he preached it right. He suffered at the hands of people that didn't like what he preached. Well, they had the right to make those choices. And he became their victim. In Luke chapter 10, when we tell the story of the Good Samaritan, well, sometimes our focus is upon the Samaritan when we need to focus sometimes upon the man that was smitten. There was a man that was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among the robbers. And they beat him up and robbed him and left him half dead. Now that's the beginning of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan, you know what he did. You know what the priest and the Levite did. But here we see that this man was a victim. He was at the hands of others, suffering because of their choices to do wrong. Why do men suffer? Some suffer because they violate the laws of nature. We've studied in Acts chapter 20 recently regarding Eutychus falling out of the upper story window. Well, now you fall out of the upper story window and see if it don't hurt you. You see, the problem is not a moral choice that you've made to be hurt or dead. But something has happened that you have violated the laws of gravity. And it's that sudden stop that'll kill you, you see. Now, did that make Eutychus a bad person? No, that's not the point. But here is a good man that's sitting listening to Paul preach, and he fell asleep and he fell out the window. And he was taken up dead. Good or bad, right or wrong, innocent or guilty, he violated the laws of nature and he suffered the consequences. You ever been in an automobile accident? One of the things I learned when I was in school, I did go to school for a little while, was that two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time. And you take two automobiles with people in it running at high speed, and they try to do that, there's going to be injuries. We understand that. That's a violation of the laws of nature, and sometimes we suffer because of that. Some suffer simply because they're righteous. We've been studying on Wednesday night in the Beatitudes, how that some suffer. And we've referenced 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning in verse 12. And we've already cited, so we will not look at all of these. Hebrews chapter 11, verse, that should be chapter 10, beginning in verse 32. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 32. We know what those Hebrews had formerly suffered because of their faith. They were suffering for righteousness' sake. Now, my friends, sometimes suffering occurs in order that we might grow in our relationship with God. You'll note in Hebrews chapter 12 that the Hebrew writer refers to that as chastening. Chastening of the Lord. Now, are there some things that I can learn from suffering? Absolutely. Yes. I might learn how to better be faithful to the Lord during times of suffering or trials and that sort of thing. You see, the suffering that God can permits can be used for the benefit of those who experience it. It can make me stronger. But it can also be used to help the lives of those who are touched by it. The Apostle Paul, I think, we'll pause and notice that in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. The Apostle Paul relates some of the suffering that he endured while he was in Asia. And if you'll turn back in your mind to the book of Acts and the 19th chapter, you'll know when Paul was in Ephesus, Demetrius led a riot of the silversmiths against Paul, and it was just a horrible experience. And Paul said here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, "We do not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning our affliction, which befell us in Asia, that we were weighed down exceedingly beyond our power, insomuch that we despaired even life. Yea, we ourselves have had the sentence of death within ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raiseth the dead." Now, why does he say that to these folks? If you'll back up into that context in verse 3, he said, "Blessed be the God and the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our affliction, that we may be able to comfort them that are in any affliction through the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God."
Now look at that carefully. What's Paul say? Look at what happened to me back over here in Asia. Why did I endure that? Well, you see, that qualified me to offer comfort to you. That helps me to help you. So was there any benefit to Paul's suffering? Yes, there was. To him personally, perhaps so. To other folks that he could preach to, absolutely. Yes. So there are some benefits to suffering. Now, when we look at Asaph, we see that he understood that when he went into the sanctuary of the Lord. Now, I want to talk just a moment here before we conclude about Job. And you've been very patient, and I appreciate that. But as we look at Job, back over in chapter 42, at the conclusion of this book, I want to call your attention to verse 1. And all these things that have happened to Job. Now, these speeches of these friends, of course, there's another speech that's made by another man that we haven't even introduced. And we haven't introduced the speech that God made. But in all of the inquiry of Job, Job's essential question from the beginning has never been answered. And as you read the book of Job and studying in this series, I want you to look to see that God really didn't answer Job's question. In fact, God didn't really say anything until you get to chapter 38. That's well into the book. And then what he said was not to answer Job's question. But here's what Job has to say when God's through talking to him. In verse 1 of chapter 42, "Then Job answered Jehovah and said, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be restrained. Who is this that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that which I understood not. Things too wonderful for me which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. I heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." Now, where does Job end up on this? Job said, well, I was wrong. I was wrong to question God. I was wrong. I was wrong to doubt God's love and God's confidence and God's ability. I was wrong about all of that. Now his answer to why has all this happened, God never answered him. But God did tell him who he is. And Job said, now I know that you can do all things and no purpose of yours can be restrained. And so it is. I repent in dust and ashes. Sorry I ever questioned. Now where does that leave us, brethren? Where does that leave us? You see, sometimes the question of, I don't understand, why has all this come upon me? Well, we can moan and bemoan. And we can complain and we can fuss. And we can blame God. We can get angry with God. But that don't help us, and that don't answer our question. And Job finally acknowledges, I don't have to have all the answers in order for me to do what God said. Now that's where he started out, wasn't it? Until all these afflictions came, all this suffering came. And now where he started out has had to be proven. I'll be faithful to God. What about you? We can't allow sufferings to disquiet us to the extent that we begin to reason like Job did, and certainly not like his friends. We can't doubt the faithfulness of God, the love, the mercy that he's extended to us, for he gave his Son. And we're going to look more as our study proceeds concerning the book of Job. But now Job sees that all of his suffering
just fades into nothing when he compares it to the eternal glory of God. The Apostle Paul made the point, "For I reckon that the sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed to us." And you think about that when bad times come. And they do come. But we want to stay focused. We want to go to heaven. Maybe I'm talking to somebody tonight that needs to obey the gospel. So many powerful lessons for us to learn. But the first one is, we must believe that God loves us. He sent His Son to die for us so that heaven can be ours. If we can help you by baptizing you into Christ for the remission of your sins, that's what we want to do. Maybe you've obeyed the gospel and you need to correct sin in your life. If we can help you by praying with you and for you, that's certainly our desire. Make that known while together we stand and while we sing.